Welcome to The Writing Life, the podcast for anyone who writes. I'm Steph McKenna, Senior Communications and Marketing Manager.
And I'm Peggy Hughes, Chief Executive.
And we're coming to you from the National Centre for Writing at Dragon Hall in Norwich, UNESCO City of Literature. Hello, Peggy Hughes.
Hello, Steph McKenna.
It's lovely to have you back.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be back. Thank you for having me.
When was the last time you were on the podcast? I think the last time we spoke on the podcast was probably Max Porter last year. But have you done any chats on the podcast since?
You know, I think you're right. I think Max was my last appearance that glorious afternoon where we three sat upstairs in the book hive.
Honestly, highlight of probably my life, that really, getting to sit with two amazing people having a conversation. That was lovely.
I haven't really. It's been a busy old year, and then now you're sort of stuck with me for the next couple of episodes, I think.
We've got like a triple whammy of Peggy interviews coming up, which if anything is just magical, really. We're very pleased to have you, and I thought it would be lovely to have you on the podcast this week to introduce this episode, not just because you are one of my favourite people, but because this episode focuses on a key figure of Norwich's literary history, and that's Harriet Martineau. And you've spent a lot of time working on activities linked to our Norwich UNESCO City of Literature designation, and that designation means that we're a city of historical and contemporary significance for writing and for storytelling. And you're regularly in touch with our huge UNESCO network of colleagues living across the world.
Absolutely right. Yes, lucky me. We are one of 53 global cities in this sort of literary family. Norwich was designated in 2012. We were the first city in England to be designated as a UNESCO City of Literature. The world's first, I feel honour-bound to say, was Edinburgh in 2004. But it's a very special badge of honour to be part of that network, and not just to, I suppose, look at the history and the figures like Harriet Martineau and others who make Norwich special. But I think the role that we try and play here at the National Centre for Writing is to think about the future literary heritage and to try and nurture the voices of tomorrow today. You know, to try and build the kind of conditions for people to enjoy writing and reading and translating, and to make Norwich a really special place to be if those are things that you love.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's such important work, and we're all hugely proud to be a part of it. And as you mentioned, Harriet Martineau is quite a key figure in Norwich's history. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about who Harriet Martineau was and what makes her so important?
You know, I gladly will, Steph. And I must be honest, it was only until when I did this interview with Stuart Hobday and with Gaby Weiner that I really got to understand her role and her prominence. You know, she's such a remarkable figure. I hope the interview will put that over, just everything that she achieved and her mode as a thinker and a writer and a journalist. But just in brief, she was a journalist and a writer. She was probably best known as a popularizer of political economy, and you know, though her career spanned many other aspects of Victorian literary culture, she was very much a daughter of Norwich. She was born just a stone's throw from where we are today in NR3, along on Magdalen Street. She was the daughter of a Unitarian Norwich cloth manufacturer, and you know, had some sadness in her early life, and her father died, and through that she needed to earn money basically, and she turned to writing, and she shot to fame in 1832 as the author of a set of short stories called Illustrations of Political Economy. And these were seemingly sort of remarkable in that they took a fictional approach to talking about ideas around the economy and the economic conditions that were impacting on the lives of ordinary people. And from that, so she became this, you know, remarkably well-regarded, sort of lionized figure, and then traveled to America. She was hugely celebrated in London, you know, traveled all over. She championed anti-slavery. She championed the rights of women and all sorts of incredible things. And then her lively, a very provocative autobiography, which was written in 1855, was published then posthumously in 1877. And despite lots of ill health, which she wrote about disability and ill health, she actually, in the later stages of her life, became a journalist and published many, many hundreds of pieces for the Daily News. And so she's a unique voice and a unique thinker. And I hope that the interview with Gaby and with Stuart will put that across. And really what we're talking about is that Gaby and Stuart together have co-authored a book called Reintroducing Harriet Martineau, Pioneering Sociologist and Activist. And through that book, they're just explaining how Martineau really was one of the world's first sociologists, basically. And to say a little bit of Stuart is a doctoral researcher in the Department of Philosophy at the University of East Anglia. And he's also the author of a book called Encounters with Harriet Martineau. And Gaby has held, many professorial and honorary research positions in the UK and in Sweden, and has written loads on Martineau. So we're in good hands, basically, with these two.
Such a fantastic figure. And this is a really timely interview as well, because next month we're hosting our 10th annual Harriet Martineau lecture at the City of Literature Strand of Norfolk and Norwich Festival. And this is supported by the Martineau Society, and it's an event we host each year which celebrates the remarkable legacy of Harriet Martineau by inviting renowned speakers to respond to her life and work. So in previous years, we've had lectures from Ali Smith, Kate Moss, Sarah Perry, Kit Duvall. And this year, we are welcoming your friend and friend of NCW, Val McDermid.
We are. I am so excited that that Val McDermid is returning to us in Norwich. Yeah, my love for Val is total, I'd say. the lecture, which as you say, is 10, which is truly a wonderful thing, was established by Stuart Hobday along with our former CEO Chris Gribble back then, and it was sort of established to try and to celebrate Martineau and to put her back on a map and in front of people by commissioning a lecture from someone who, as we like to say, is sort of travelling in the spirit of Martineau. And Val, now world-renowned writer of crime fiction, queen of crime, really. But before she was publishing crime fiction, she herself was a journalist. And so we just felt she would be a brilliant person to deliver something special in the 10th year. We don't know too much yet, but we do know that Val's just publishing this year a book on Lady Macbeth. And I'm led to believe that the lecture will explore themes of power and, what power is through the lens of Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. So it's going to be great. And I'm sorry to say, I think it's already sold out, Steph, am I right?
It has. I was about to say the Harriet Martineau lecture each year is a very popular event, but this year is, it sold out so quickly, which is hugely exciting for us. Sorry for anyone who hasn't managed to grab a ticket to see Val in person, but for anyone who does miss out, we are hoping to present the lecture at a later stage online for everyone to enjoy. So keep your eyes and ears peeled, and that will come to you very shortly. So without further ado, let's move on to the main segment of today's podcast and Peggy's chat with Stuart Hobday and Gaby Weiner, who have worked together to write a new book called Reintroducing Harriet Martineau, Pioneering Sociologist and Activist.
Hello to you both, Gaby Weiner and Stuart Hobday, and thank you so much for joining us on The Writing Life, the Centre for Writing, Writing's podcast. Yeah. Where are you both calling from today? We're online today. Where are you both?
Well, I'm calling from Lewes, which is near Brighton in the south of England.
Yeah, and I'm in Norwich, not too far away from you, Peggy, I think. I don't know. Where are you?
Lovely. I'm in the North City of Norwich today. I'm at home today for this one. Yeah, so thank you both. We're here today to discuss the wonderful Harriet Martineau, a person and a topic dear to both of your hearts. Before we get into kind of what makes Martineau such a very special figure, I wonder if you could both kick us off. We'll come to you first, Gaby. Just a little bit about your background and your road to Martineau, as it were.
Okay. Well, I'm an academic. I trained as a teacher, and then I did a master's and went into higher education. I was a researcher, and I was at one particular time. When I was working in London, I was a half time. I had a half time post, so I was kind of looking for work. And a woman called Dale Spender, who was quite a well known feminist in London at the time, she's from Australia. She's recently died, actually. She was writing a book on feminist theorists, in the broadest sense. And I had done for my undergraduate project, I'd done a biography of Vida Goldstein, who's an Australian suffragette. So she was going to publish that chapter, but she wanted me to investigate Harriet Martineau, and I'd never heard of her. So I spent, you know, a lot of time, because it was in the days, this is in the 80s, it was the days before anything was online. You had to go to libraries, you had to go to books, you know, to find out about her. And it took me a long time to kind of place her. But once I placed her, I was hooked. And I did my, eventually I did a PhD on her, and I've subsequently written about her. So.
Yeah, very interesting, that idea of placing her. I wonder if it's premature to get into what you mean by that. Is that to say she had such a breadth, her, you know, as a writer and as a thinker, that it was hard to kind of fathom her?
The problem I had was that she was a lone woman as a feminist. She was in she was working really in the 1830s, in the 1820s, 30s and 40s. That was before the first wave feminist movement. And in fact, she was you know, very important to that. And Mary Wollstonecraft had been writing a little bit earlier. But it was only individuals. There wasn't a movement. There weren't a group. So to try and find out where she stood and what she was very, very difficult. And so it took me quite a long time to think, as you say, place her.
Okay, we're definitely going to try and place her in this conversation today. So we will come back to that. But Stuart, we'll bring you in with who are you, Stuart Hobday, and and what led you to Harriet Martineau?
Who am I?
Yeah,
sorry, it's a bit Les Mis there.
I'm Stuart Hobday, and I was studying Darwin, and I kept, but that's quite a long time ago for my masters in the 90s, and I kept coming across this name Harriet Martineau, and then I found out she was from Norwich, and I'd come from Norwich, and I was thinking, you know, people don't know her in Norwich at all, and yet the more I delved in, there was quite a lot of interest in her, but it was almost particularly in America, there was a lot of American interest in her, and so I got involved. Me and Gaby are both in a thing called the Martineau Society, and that's been really helpful to both of us over the last 20 years, and longer for Gaby. And so I wrote my own book. I researched and wrote my own book about Harriet Martineau, which is called Encounters with Harriet Martineau. And
it's a brilliant book.
I paid her to say that. and then we got invited to co-author a book for Routledge, which has come out recently, which is placing Martineau in the development of social science in the 19th century. And we sort of co-authored it. We worked together on it. And that was it's our latest project, really. And it was a good project. But I suppose for me, Martineau was sort of written out of history. So that's interesting in itself that, you know, she was very scientifically minded, but very much sort of an all-rounder, but an influential person and an influential writer. I think, you know, we'll probably come back to it. She was almost too radical. She became quite atheistic. And I think that meant that the establishment sort of turned on her a bit and regarded her as a bit of a freak, really, and was almost too outspoken for her own good in the 19th century. But, you know, in Norwich, I've sort of been on a bit of a mission because, as you know, a few years ago, we founded an annual Harriet Martineau lecture, which is run with yourselves at the writers at the National Centre for Writing. And that's been good for getting her some recognition in Norwich. And that's coming up soon in May as part of the Norfolk and Norwich Festival, isn't it? So that's good.
It is. And we will be circling back on that, because this podcast, I suppose, is pointing both to your book, but also to that event that's coming up in May. I wonder, what you were saying there about her being sort of both out of her time and beyond her time, and, you know, this remarkable woman who, you know, had no real precursors. I wonder, maybe who would like to speak to this, to how she became the writer and the thinker she was. What was she like as a? I think we need to position her now in this podcast. What was she like as a child? What forged her? Is that you, Stuart, or is that you, Gaby? Would like to?
I'll have a go. I think she was very much of her time as well. So that was the thing. She was of her time, but very much ahead of her time in a lot of ways. She grew up in a kind of middle-class family in Norwich. Her father was a factory, he owned a factory making textiles. She was Unitarian and went to the Octagon Chapel and does talk about that. Just as she was getting into her 20s, a lot of things happened. Her father went bankrupt because there was a major downturn in the textile industry at the time. She had a fiancé who, one could say, helpfully died. and she needed money, basically. She needed to earn money. And one of the openings for a middle-class woman like her sisters was to become a governess or to become a teacher. But she was deaf. She had she couldn't hear very well. So that was not possible for her. And she took to her pen and she wrote. And she was a brilliant, Stuart would probably agree, she's a brilliant writer across all the genres, if you like, she wrote. And that sustained her throughout her life. And she managed in the end to recover she was never short of money again, and she enabled her the freedom to write across a whole range of subjects. And she became incredibly well known in the 1830s. She wrote this political economy series based on the work of James Mill and John Stuart Mill. But she wrote it as she wrote some fiction. It was a fictional exemplar of his theories, and the fiction was quite good. The fiction was very good, and so basically everybody read it. She was read very. This series was a terrific success, and everybody read it because they liked the fiction and they felt it was kind of it was quite intellectual. It was quite knowledgeable. It was a knowledgeable thing. They would learn more. So, and she became on the back of that. She became very, very famous, which is ironic since she's dropped out of that now. So over to Stuart. Sorry, didn't want to dominate.
Can I ask either of you, whoever best to say, but of that sort of form that she struck upon, this fictional, style about these big ideas, huge ideas, how unusual was that as a genre, if you like, as a form at the time?
It was unusual. She definitely became the story she started to tell. She wrote economic parables in a style of fiction, and they became very popular. So I think she was almost the first person to write about economics in a popular way. And Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, has recently written a chapter about Harriet Martineau in her book, acclaiming her as the first person to write about economics to the general public. So definitely it was that. I mean, going back to the other question, I would say she was shaped by Norwich, and she was a manufacturer's daughter. And that experience of her father ran a textiles business and it collapsed. The impact of that was huge on the family, but also it was part of a depression in Norwich between 1825 and 1830. And watching that really affected her. And she started to read became a voracious reader, and that about economics. She read Adam Smith and other economists, and that suddenly informed. So she was putting economic theory into these tales that hit a nerve in the 1830s, the early 1830s. So it was unusual. As Gaby said, she was partly a product of that time. This was before major industrialization as well. The textiles industries of Norwich, people bringing stuff in and out up the river near where they lived, was a good example of almost like a cottage industry, really, people working from home in small factories.
Yeah, I think in the book you say, where I said she was out of time, and Gaby, you challenged that, but I think you say in the book that she was born at just the right time, that those influences kind of were she was able to capitalize or to
Well, there was a growth in literacy as well in the first 30 years of the 19th century, and that was the start of organized education, really. And so there was a public ready to a more public involvement. You've got 1832 Reform Act again. It was generally regarded as a turning point in democracy in Britain. Getting away from the old landed gentry to more representation of people going to parliament and people being more opinionated. So she was definitely a part of that whole thing. People wanted to know what was going on, what governments were doing.
And if I can mention one particular story, the tale she there were 13 in all. How many? 13? One was called Demerara, which was discussing the economic basis of slave trade of slavery is set in the Caribbean, and it was very much based on Adam Smith's arguments about the not only was slavery morally indefensible, but it was also uneconomic. It was a bad deal, and that particular book was read across the world. And when she went, in the 30s, after she'd finished this series of books, she went to America, and everybody had read Demerara, everybody she met. Now, we couldn't think of a book that would maybe have such an impact. So wherever she went, they knew about Demerara, and the southern states wanted to convince her that she was wrong, and the northern states wanted to, she sided in the end with the northern states and the abolitionists. But so she was very, very powerful in the 1830s.
And it was a sort of remarkable story of Martineau in some ways, was she went from being quite a shy, deaf person in Norwich in her 20s, not being sociable, to suddenly striking a nerve with this writing in the 1830s, and suddenly she did become globally famous in the literate world. So, like in the French court, encouraged everybody to read stories around the French court, and in the Russian czar as well, lauded her tales about economics. And so it was slightly typical of Harriet was on hearing that she was very popular in Russia, she then wrote a tale being critical of the Russian Tsar and the Russian court and generally about the treatment of Polish people in Russia, that they were second-class citizens, treated as second-class citizens. And the Tsar ordered her books to be burnt, and she was banned from Russia. And years later, she joked in a letter to someone, she said, "I must tell you one day how I'm still banned from Russia."
I mean, it's all fascinating to me that what you just said, though, about how she was this shy, young woman in her 20s, and suddenly through her work became lionized. I mean, that degree of fame and celebrity, even.
Yeah.
What else do we know of how she handled that? Because I think we think sometimes that writers, that's a new idea, that now writers have a public self and festivals and appearances and things. But clearly it's just not. So I wonder if maybe, Gaby, is that you? Could you say a bit to how she handled that?
One of the things that I found in my research for my PhD was that there was historians who've looked at her have always commented about her appearance, poor, plain woman. And there was a lot of debate about what she looked like. But Stuart and I have found the cover of our paperback is a painting of her done when she went to America. She was in her early 30s. Painted while she was in the Senate, in listening to what was happening in America. And she's beautiful in that. Now, and the later pictures, because photography comes in, show a rather pleasant-looking woman. So it's kind of interesting how historians continually frame women, however intellectual, however competent, based on her looks. But the interesting about Martineau, she went to America with a companion, and she seemed, in the way she described, because she wrote some books about it, she seemed very confident when facing, confident to speak publicly, confident when meeting, very senior people. She met the president, she met, lots of families. She went down to the southern states, she met slave families, and she seemed to conduct herself with a great deal of authority. You know, some people might see it as arrogance, but she seemed, to not be fazed by meeting these people. You know, she was it's quite an interesting image, because so much of what we hear about women in the 19th century was that they were silent. You know, well, there were women who weren't silent.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely. Stuart, do you have anything? Did you want to follow on any of that?
I mean, throughout her life, some of the reviews that she got were pretty shocking by modern standards.
Yes.
In that they lampooned her as a sort of, deaf and generally commented negatively about her appearance and
spinsterhood.
Yeah, just generally sort of what we would now regard as overt sexism was pretty normal in reviews of Harriet Martineau. And so and she just sort of batted it away. I think, you know, that's what's amazing is she just.
But she did read them. We think she did. She did follow how others viewed her. Would you say?
She definitely read reviews, but she just batted it away, carried on, and she definitely had an indomitable sort of spirit as a writer. I think was just sort of used to that sort of thing. But reviews could be vitriolic. And after she visited America, she wrote a book like Society in America, which was overtly critical of the American system, particularly slavery. And again, this is, you know, in the late 1830s when we're quite a long way past like Wilberforce and, you know, where we tend to think slavery ended, whereas slavery carried on in America until the American Civil War. And she was almost a lone voice criticizing America. But after Society in America, you know, reviews in America said they'll invite her back to cut out her tongue, you know, so, and things like that, you know. So she was generally regarded, and I think that then becomes almost a way of dismissing her as well. I think, you know, it's sort of too a bit crazy when actually.
So Charles Dickens did say that Society in America was the best book he'd ever read about America at that time. So it got some very good reviews as well. It depended what where you stood politically, I suppose. Yeah, the other thing about America is she was very critical of the treatment of women.
Yeah.
She was a campaigner for all kinds of social justice, but I would say her focus was on particularly on women and on slavery. Those were two, but there was, as we show in the book, she wrote very well about disability, in a very modern way nowadays, about disability, about the environment. So there were a lot of other things, but I think her main passions were equality for women, particularly to work, and the abolition of slavery. Would you agree, Stuart? Or
I think it's quite hard to say. What I would say, her main passion was progress.
Yeah,
and she developed an underlying belief in that humans were on a progressive path, and that started with the Unitarianism. You know, a lot. It's amazing how many progressive voices came out of Unitarianism. So all sorts of writers in the 19th century came from a Unitarian background, and the progressiveness was part of their philosophy. So she was brought up with that. But then she really moved on and discovered and translated people like Comte, who wrote about it in a much more, you know, obvious and upfront way that, you know, the Comtean philosophy of positivism is basically a progressive philosophy. And she became a real advocate for that. And that became really influential in the development of social sciences. And there are people who, you know, like John Gray has written about how it's been a hidden philosophy in Western philosophy, but it's actually been really powerful and is behind a lot of science, a lot of development of science. And that we still have a sort of underlying initiative of progress.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, how did she, where did, what sort of informed or conditioned her her desire for social progress? I think you've probably answered that in terms of her Unitarian upbringing.
Yeah.
But I will ask you, Stuart, because, go on.
Well, she definitely became more scientifically minded as time went on. And we try to reflect that in our book to show how that happened, because people often, she was most famous for the economic tales that we've talked about, the 1830s, the economic parables. But actually, the second half of her life, I think, contains some of her most radical scientifically minded texts, and actually were hugely influential, as Gaby said, with things like disability, but also a partnership with Florence Nightingale. Mm-hmm. They work together, statistically show how hospitals should be healthier, nursing needs training, doctors need training, and that's become a global thing, really. You know, it's hugely influential.
Can I come back to something that Gaby mentioned of you, Stuart, that, you know, being an admirer of her writing, and I wonder if you could articulate what it is about her actual writing that's admirable to you.
It's very direct, her writing. I find it very readable. I mean, her tales are interesting. Princess Victoria, before she became the queen, she read the stories, but without she enjoyed them without the economy. And if you read, and we've both read a lot of her work, it's extraordinarily engaging. I mean, even in her most, if you like, Society in America, which is a theoretical discussion of America, there are lots and lots. She gave case studies. She gave examples from her own life that draw the reader into the importance of what she's saying. Also, what you find from her letters, because Deborah Logan has collected a huge amount of her letters together, that her whole life was spent in writing, in publishing. So she was, if she wasn't writing, she was correcting proofs. She was sending out her copy. She was getting books back to research. So she was intellectually, writing was her life, and writing was the way that she campaigned. And I found her writing, extraordinarily compelling, even after 150 years.
Yeah, she's always very honest in her writing, Harriet Martineau. She doesn't hold back, and occasionally she's very funny. I think me and Gabriel have always championed Martineau as a funny writer as well. And often you have to realise, like in something like the autobiography, it did scandalise people when it came out, and that was after she died. And it was because it was indiscreet, really, about individuals that she had mixed feelings about. So it's very, very honest person. And she just had a very, very good, occasionally, she comes out with phrases that leap off the page. And it's another thing she's become known for is sort of aphorisms and quotes. There's quite a lot of Harriet Martineau attributed quotes. And so she had a wit about her and a directness. And what I would also say is, building on what I said before, that I think her writing got better and more direct as she got older as well. So it's worth seeking out the journalism that she wrote for the Daily News, over 2,000 articles in the Daily News, which was a national paper. But again, they were produced anonymously. And so she should have been famous for that alone, really, because she was the first female journalist, retained journalist in the world. And she was writing constantly about the American Civil War, again, a lone voice as we were leading up to the American Civil War against slavery, but other things as well. That's where a lot of the health and hospitals and Nightingale stuff is. But it's not that's the one section, I think, still, it's not that easy to get hold of. Some of Martineau's writings have become more widely available, particularly on Kindles and things like that, on free digitized things. But actually, journalism... There is a book of her journalism, but I found it quite... I don't think it's ever been published over here.
It starts to touch on my next question, Stuart, you know, around the, obviously access, the work not being accessible is a barrier to people remembering or understanding more about Martineau. But, you know, we're hearing from you both about this extraordinary kind of intellect, this amazingly funny, witty, forthright woman. And yet, to go back to the top, she's not someone that we know enough. What happened then? You know, from this peak of celebrity, what happened that she sort of disappeared or that her reputation changed?
I mean, she scandalized her friends and society. There was one particular book she wrote in partnership with Henry Atkinson called Letters on the Man's Nature, on the Laws of Man's Nature. And it was fairly overtly atheistic in the book we wrote. I collected some of the responses, actually partly in the friends' letters, but also again in reviews, and they were sort of lampooned and ridiculed. And I think it was Adrian Desmond, in his biography of Huxley, said for many people it was their first encounter with the unimaginable. And so this is 10 years before Darwin's Origin of Species controversy. Personally, I think after that was a turning point. She was sort of written out of history and forgotten. Basically, it was Elizabeth Gaskell who said, Her mind was twisted, she described Harriet Martineau as.
Can I also say that in those days, I mean, in the 19th century, you know, you published, books were published, and then they went out, they were in the library. There wasn't any kind of, unless you were a very famous novelist, you weren't read. And so she wrote a vast amount of stuff, but it was in articles, it was in journals, it was in letters, it was in newspaper columns, and also in novels and in books. But what's happened recently, and I think it's a tremendous change, is that people have, it's now much more available. People have collected her work together. Letters have been collected. It's been major publications of her work. And also Gutenberg, you know, her, all her major work is online now, so you can actually access it with a click. And so it's allowed, I think, it's allowed much more access to her work and much more access to the interesting bits of her writing. And so I think that that's also contributed the changes in technology nowadays. The fact, you know, with the Martineau Society, Stuart mentioned that where we met, it's a group of scholars who are interested in the Martineau family. And they're in America, in Germany, in Scandinavia. And we communicate by email. We send each other articles by email. We, you know, so there's new connections, new media, which has made it made her much more interesting and available.
Yes, it's lovely to think she's still bringing people together in communion of ideas and so on. Before we move on to your book, which I very much want to do, just of her later years then, I'm fascinated to learn from the book that she headed off to Ambleside and was working there alongside people like William Wordsworth and Matthew Arnold, and that she took up smoking for health reasons delights me enormously. So is there anything else in there that you would, you know, that when in your journey with Martineau that's especially surprising in all that you've just said that stands out as a particularly Martineau-ish gesture?
I mean, she became known, it's apocryphal, but she became known for sort of wandering around in hobnail boots in Ambleside smoking cigars. And she certainly in Ambleside, I think, became a fairly renowned character. And she lived, you know, she did a lot of walking. And one of the things we write about in her book was how once she was in the Lake District, she really developed an affinity for nature and walking in the fells. But she did used to walk up to Wordsworth's house. And it said, and this was an elderly Wordsworth, but it was said that if he saw her coming, he would hide. And, and his wife would deal with her. But, you know, she was certainly a bit of a character, you know. But again,
and she's very concerned about the local community, and she helped build cottages for workmen, and she gave lectures, and she was very concerned about her local community. And so, and then she became, as we show in the book, she became very concerned about the environment and in a way criticised the extension of industrialisation and urbanisation because, it grew during her lifetime, this whole the Industrial Revolution. And I think towards the end of her life, she became an environmentalist. We show she became an environmentalist and was concerned that industry should not encroach on what she saw as the beauty of the landscape. So that was, and we thought that was very interesting for youngsters now who are looking towards models of people who had who were concerned about the environment. And there was Harriet Martineau in the 1860s, the 1850s and 60s, really writing about the environment and how. So yeah, so that we think that's an important extension of what we know
from the heart of. The heart of industrialization, what she was saying was, again, probably not very well received or popular.
It's a bit of a contradiction in her work because she was an advocate of science and progress and technology, but she also developed this big, huge respect for nature, I think, you know, and sort of felt we need to live in harmony with nature. And she wrote about that. But also she designed her own house in the Lake District and she built it as a farm, a self-sustaining farm. She had a cow and a pig and 10 chickens and again I think she wrote she was very proud she'd only spent £2 in the whole year, 1 year, and because she was just living in a self-sustaining way with food and development, but again it's hard to say what the locals made of it, but generally yes, you know, a bit of a contradiction, but not once I think you get to realize she always developed this regard that we needed to regard nature with more respect.
Yeah. So to speak then about the book, which we've teased out little bits and bobs as we've gone along, but I wonder if you could give us a sense. I think you were invited to write it by Routledge. How does it placing Martineau as a sociologist, what does it add, would you say, to the scholarship already existing about Martineau?
The thing is, when Harriet Martineau was writing, there were no disciplines in the sense that we know today. They were, so a lot of the Victorians were very, we think of them as very, you know, as writing across a whole range of things, subjects. And so she was interested in progress and society. and she was interested in analysing society. And that's what she did when, for instance, when she went to America and came back and wrote her book about society in America. So subsequently, sociologists have claimed her as an early sociologist. She did translate Comte, as Stuart's pointed out, who was one of the earliest theorists around sociology. And so one of the strands the main strand we pick up in the book is about how she understood society. And I think we were approached because the Routledge was wanted to develop a list on sociologists and wanted more women because, you know, it's very male, as in most disciplines, certainly in the 19th century, it was very male dominated. And the fact that as a woman, she could emerge like this was extraordinary because, you know, she didn't go to university. She had no access to university. Or, you know, she was writing from her own knowledge and her own understanding. And so, and we were able very much to establish her as an early sociologist who was interested in progress, interested in science as a basis for progress. That's why she was anti-religious. It was because she saw religion as kind of organized religion in particular, getting in the way of science and progress. And we managed to, you know, there was a range of sociological topics that she wrote about that mm-hmm. could very easily go into any sociological textbook. And in fact, Giddens, in his Tony Giddens is a major sociologist. He has her as the only woman sociologist, early sociologist. He has a right at the beginning of his book. So mm-hmm. She is known to sociologists, students, sociological students, but you know, we're trying to develop those ideas further.
Brilliant. And Stuart, obviously you've both written about her before, but how was it to be in a co-writing collab? How did this work in practice between the two of you from Norwich and Lewis?
Well, the answer is that Gaby took the lead, and I did as I was told.
That's not true.
But it was enjoyable. You know, it is a bit different because we met several times and talked through ideas, talked through what we wanted to emphasise, and then we divvied up the chapters, but then shared the chapters once we'd written them and spoke to each other about them, and gradually. So it is very much a co-written book, and yeah, just I mean, going back to what Gaby was saying, like it is interesting to place Martineau as a sociologist. I think for me, I have to admit, I'm probably less academically minded and I don't feel the need to pigeonhole Harriet Martineau. I find her, you know, just a really fascinating writer in a broad sense and someone who was just almost a very individual voice in the 19th century. So it's almost like in the development of history, the 19th century is still a key period, I think, for understanding the world as it is now. And I think we managed to pick out some of those things. As I said, the development of hospitals, you know, it's a major thing. And you could argue, well, it would have happened anyway. But actually, Martineau and Florence Nightingale really influenced how hospitals and medical training developed. And that's just one.
By the use of statistics. By the use of statistics. So that was, and that's a major area of sociology nowadays, statistics. So they developed methodologies that are important today.
I think in this whole conversation and in the book, it's one of the things that stands out is just how many disciplines to which she contributed that have been hidden from history.
I just wanted to make a plea for her being seen as a sociologist, because I think it's all very well to think of herself as a 19th century figure, which she was, but that's been a problem because it doesn't really get you to people who are interested. So you have, I think, if we write about her as a sociologist or a journalist or a feminist, we embed her in different disciplinary areas, which means that there's a wider readership for her work. That attracted me to writing about her as a sociologist. Also, I actually think she was a sociologist in our understanding of the term. So it wasn't difficult to lay out the ground.
Yeah. It's a sort of Martineau development technique by stealth, though, to reach a wider, different bookshelves. I want to ask a little bit. We have touched on the Martineau Society and the lecture that is a co-commission from the Society and from the National Centre for Writing, and which then it happens at the Norfolk and Norwich Festival. And this year it's the 10th chapter of that lecture that you put in train, Stuart, all those years ago. It's the 10th one,
I'm led
to understand, which is brilliant, really brilliant. I wonder, Stuart, do you want to tell us a little bit about where that, obviously I think we can understand where the impulse came from, but just, the backstory to that lecture and also who's doing the lecture for us this year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely, I'd become an advocate for Martineau in Norwich, and I met Chris Gribble, who was running the Writers' Centre as it was then, and we were talking through ideas, really, and we agreed that an annual lecture would be a really good way of remembering Martineau, partly because she was multifaceted and it was quite a depth of responses that people could come up with. It wouldn't be too restrictive, but we agreed to have this annual event in the, I think, what we call the spirit of Martineau, and that's how it's been. The 10 lectures have been very diverse, mainly by women writers. I think there was one male slipped in there, but you can't have everything. and they have been really diverse. The novelist Ali Smith gave the first lecture, and I think at the time she really got into it. She really got into Martineau, and she subsequently, I think I always remember one of the things she said, start a campaign for getting Martineau on the £5 note. And subsequently, she named the family in her next novel, which is Martineau, which is, so in the novel How to Be Both, the family are called Martineau after she did the Martineau lecture. So it's had a, and there are other stories I could tell like that. I think Sarah Perry would be another one who went to delve into how Essex girls as a brand are seen, and that became her next book. I think she fed it into her next book.
And she said that Harriet Martineau was really an Essex girl. she was really.
How could Norwich feel about that? Was Norwich happy with that?
Sure.
Conclusion.
But it's been it's been a nice strand of activity. Still, still really hard to get someone like Martineau the recognition that we think she should have, which is partly why. Yeah, I mean, we're plugging away to get Martineau the recognition we deserve, but it is hard. It's one of those things. So the lecture is good, but I think we definitely feel she's almost ripe for a good movie or a TV series. She did have these very dramatic aspects in her life. She sort of went to America in 1834 and sailed across on a boat as a deaf young lady, and it was slightly typical of Martineau that she asked the captain to strap her to the mast of the ship because she was deaf. She wanted to feel the force of the storm. They were in a storm. She said, could I be strapped to the mast for this duration of this storm, because she wanted to feel it, storm, and she was a bit like that. She was always out and about, always sociably interested in people. And so it definitely lends itself to some sort of, so is anybody from Netflix listening or?
who on earth would play this woman though?
I think it would be
Olivia Colman.
I think she'd be excellent.
And she would be super, another Norfolk, brilliant Norfolk woman.
She'd be excellent.
Netflix, I hope you're listening. Superb. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I think we're nearly there. Is there anything, and we can isolate this so it runs on, but is there anything you would like to find that I've not asked that you would like to?
You didn't mention who was this year's
Val.
Harriet Martineau lecture.
Yeah. Okay, and Stuart, this year we've got Val McDermott is going to be delivering this year's Harriet Martineau lecture, and that's going to be really exciting. I think it's nearly already sold out, to be honest.
Wow. That's good.
It's going to be a big one. That's brilliant. I think she's going to do a wonderful job. She's got a book coming out. It's just out in early May on Lady Macbeth. Yeah. So I think her her and Val herself was a journalist for many years in with the Red Tops Daily Record and things. So yeah. I think it will be a really fascinating look at journalism, women power, all sorts of things.
The thing I'd quite like to work on is I think there should be a building at UEA named after Harriet Martineau. But so again, if this gets through to anybody at UEA, it'd be good to have a conversation about getting a building named about her there, because UEA was one of those universities, I think, that were built largely on social sciences and in the 60s. And Martineau really influenced that whole development of social sciences in the first half of the 20th century.
And she'd be so pleased that so many women are in higher education and doing sociology, because she was so much, she was such a campaigner for women's right to work and to study.
Well, I think that's a brilliant place to end on the very idea that we might, from this humble podcast, get a building named after Martineau and a Netflix miniseries. So let's travel in hope. I want to just thank you both again very much for your time and presence and conversation, and for bringing Martineau to us and to many others. Thank you.
Thanks, Peggy.
A big thank you to Stuart Hobday, Gaby Weiner, and our very own Peggy Hughes for their time. And don't forget to check out the City of Literature Weekend, which includes the annual Harriet Martineau Lecture, taking place in Norwich between the 24th and the 26th of May, over on the NCW website.
If you have any questions or you want to get in touch, you can find us at Writers Centre on Twitter and on Instagram. We're on Facebook, and you can sign up to the NCW newsletter at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk. We're also scheduling a mailbag episode for in a few weeks' time. So if you have any pressing questions for us about NCW, about the podcast or the craft of writing or anything else, do drop us an email at info@nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk.
As a UK registered charity, we rely on the generosity of our supporters to make our work possible. You can make a donation today over on the website by clicking the Support Us button. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard today, please do consider subscribing to the Writing Life podcast and leaving us a 5-star rating and a review, because it helps other people to find us.
Thanks again, everyone. Keep writing, and I'll catch you on the next episode.